This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Station. Visit kpft.org for information about the program council. This is KPFT Houston.
Good morning. Welcome to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you here on March the 12th. Coming up in just a few minutes, Manisha Thakur is going to be joining me. She is the co-author of On My Two Feet, A Modern Girl's Guide to Personal Finance. We're going to be talking about how to save and invest, achieve financial security, and how to own your finances and own your life. Manisha Thakur coming up in just a few minutes. Our address on the web, newcapitalshow.com, and you can also find the New Capital Show on Apple's iTunes. I should publicize this more. I don't do it enough. Everyone's now carrying iPhones, and our web guru, Stephen Reitman, we had lunch the other day, and he pulls out his iPhone and he says, Have you ever seen the New Capital Show on the iPhone, on iTunes? And there it is, right there. You can download it from iTunes. And if the phone, this is amazing, if the phone rings, it puts the New Capital Show on pause. And you have your phone conversation, and then you go back, and here comes the New Capital Show again. Of course, it's not just New Capital Show. It's whatever you're listening to. But that was amazing. I'm still using this antiquated cell phone. It's challenging enough for me. So there it is. If you're now carrying an iPhone, you can download and program your iPhone to download our show. If you have any problems with how to do that, I think there are instructions on the website at newcapitalshow.com. If you have problems, send me an email, and I'll send it to Stephen, and he'll send you a reply. Just a few pieces I want to get to from the New York Times that have emerged or have been published in the past week, one from Tom Friedman and the other from David Leonhardt. As I said last week, there is some tremendous, tremendous reporting going on these days about the crisis. And I'm calling it the crisis. I've been calling it the chasm. I did an interview last week, and I was asked, is it a recession? Is it a depression? My response was, I don't know what it is. It's other than it's a chasm. We've fallen into a chasm. And to me, the chasm is related to the fact that we have a new economy, in my opinion, that's going to emerge, that is emerging. We're leaving an old type of economy, and we didn't put the foundations in place fast enough for the new economy. We didn't make the right investments in time. And what happens when you don't plan for something? You go into a chasm. We will come out of the chasm. We will come out to that new economy. But the crisis in leadership, as I see it in our country, is that those foundations for the new economy were not put in place. In fact, many of our leadership fought the establishment of those foundations. To that effect, Tom Friedman, in a piece this week, says, let's today step out of the normal boundaries of analysis of our economic crisis and ask a radical question, which for many of us at KPFT really won't be that radical, but it's radical for him. He says, what if the crisis of 2008 represents something much more fundamental than a deep recession? What if it's telling us that the whole growth model we created over the last 50 years is simply unsustainable economically and ecologically? And that 2008 was when we hit the wall, when Mother Nature and the market both said, no more. We have created a system for growth that depended on our building more and more stores to sell more and more stuff made in more and more factories in China powered by more and more coal that would cause more and more climate change, but earn China more and more dollars to buy more and more U.S. T-bills, so America would have more and more money to build more and more stores and sell more and more stuff that would employ more and more China. And you get the point. Friedman says, we can't do this anymore. I agree. We've been saying this since before Tom Friedman's been saying it, but he says it very well. Let's give him credit. Friedman was wrong on the war in Iraq. We said so. He now says so. So we'll give the guy credit. He knows when to admit a mistake. Joe Rahm, and this is a Friedman quoting a physicist and climate expert who writes what he says is an indispensable blog, climateprogress.org. Joe Rahm says, we created a way of raising living standards that we cannot possibly pass on to our children. We've been getting rich by depleting all of our natural stocks, water, hydrocarbons, forests, rivers, fish, and arable land, and not by generating renewable flows. That's a great phrase, renewable flows. That's the new economy, in my opinion. Renewable flows. Economics are about flows. Warren Buffett likes to say, whenever you're thinking in economic terms, you should always ask the question, and then what? And then what? So when you're thinking economically, you're thinking, and then what? That implies a flow. And this physicist, Joe Rahm, says we need to be thinking about renewable flows, flows that can go back to where they began and renew and not destroy. He goes on to say, you can get this burst of wealth that we have created recently from this rapacious behavior, but it has to collapse unless adults stand up and say, this is a Ponzi scheme. Apropos of the phrase Ponzi scheme, Bernard Madoff pleaded guilty in court today. And what this physicist Joe Rahm is not just implying, he's flat out saying, is that the way we structure the economy is a form of a Ponzi scheme. Taking from our stocks, what he calls our natural stocks, depleting them utterly, and having an inability to renew them. Rahm finishes by saying, we have not generated real wealth, and we are destroying a livable climate. Real wealth is something you can pass on in a way that others can enjoy. I think this is an important article by Tom Friedman. I agree 100% with it. Can't say that about many things, but I do with this. David Leonhardt, also doing great work at the Times, writing in his column, Economics. He says, 16 years ago, two economists published a research paper with a delightfully simple title, Looting. That's looting, L-O-O-T-I-N-G. The economists were George Akerlof, who would later win a Nobel Prize, and Paul Romer, the renowned expert on economic growth. In the paper, they argued that several financial crises in the 1980s, like the Texas real estate bust, we know about that. These financial crises from the 80s had been the result of private investors taking advantage of the government. Again, the result of private investors taking advantage of the government. The investors had borrowed huge amounts of money, made big profits when times were good, and then left the government holding the bag for their eventual and predictable losses. In a word, the investors looted. Someone trying to make an honest profit, Professors Akerlof and Romer said, would have operated in a completely different manner. The investors displayed a, quote, total disregard for even the most basic principles of lending. Failing to verify standard information about their borrowers, or in some cases, even to ask for that information. The investors, again, quoting the economists, acted as if future losses were somebody else's problem, and Akerlof and Romer concluded they were right. The future losses were somebody else's problem. Fast forward, David Leonhardt says, think about the so-called liar's loans from recent years, like those Texas real estate loans from the 1980s. They never had a chance of paying off. Sure, they would deliver big profits for a while, so long as the bubble kept inflating. But when they inevitably imploded, the losses would overwhelm the gains. Gretchen Morgenson, also of the New York Times, has reported that Merrill Lynch's losses from the past 2 years wiped out its profits from the previous decade. But you know what? Doesn't matter to Stanley O'Neill. Stan O'Neill ran Merrill Lynch, earned $100, $200 million during that time, and I don't think there's any way to get that money back. Leonard says, what happened? Banks borrowed money from lenders around the world. The bankers then kept a big chunk of that money for themselves, calling it, quote, management fees or, quote, performance bonuses. Once the investments were exposed as hopeless, the lenders, ordinary savers, foreign countries, other banks, you name it, were repaid with government bailouts. And here is the key sentence. In effect, the bankers had siphoned off this bailout money in advance, years before the government had spent it. To me, that's an amazing, amazing conclusion. Leonhardt, later on in the article, says he's not saying that this was absolutely conceived in a nefarious conspiracy of executives talking to each other, but that it was understood, internalized, and understood at the very depths of the way that these executives behaved. They understood that in looting this money early, they were looting money that would ultimately have to be put back into the institutions by a government bailout, a massive government bailout, and they were in effect, looting the public treasury. And so it goes. The news continues to come out. What does all this mean for the country? What does it mean for the world? As I've said many times, I'm optimistic about the future, if only because we're now starting to truly grapple with the problems. It's been a long, lonely journey at places like KPFT, where we've been trying to bring to the attention of a wider audience the problems built into our economic systems. And at least now, people are truly beginning to see what needs to be done. And that's good. What does it mean for you? Coming up in just a moment, Manisha Thakur is going to be joining me, and we are going to be talking about personal finance today. We'll be taking your calls a bit later in the show also. 713-526-5738 is the number to call. This is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. Back in just a moment.
Who can turn the world on with a smile? Who can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile? Well, it's you, girl, and you should know it. With each glance and every little movement you show it. Love is all I know. Big girl, this time you're all alone. But it's time you started living. It's time you let someone else do some giving. Love is all I know, no need to waste it. You can have the time, why don't you take it? You're gonna make it after all.
Welcome back to the New Capital Show. Manisha Thakur has over 15 years of experience working in the financial services industry. She is a chartered financial analyst, charter holder, and co-author of On My Own Two Feet. She is now on a mission to help American women learn how to live their lives from a position of financial strength. Manisha's financial literacy advocacy work has been featured in national publications such as... You sitting down? You ready for this? The New York Times, Business Week, U.S. News and World Report, Glamour, and Women's Day. Manisha's national TV appearances include CNN's Your Bottom Line, CNBC's Power Lunch, NBC Nightly News, ABC's America This Morning, and the Fox Business Network. She is a regular personal finance blogger on the Huffington Post, and it's great to have her here in the studio today. Welcome, Manisha. Welcome to the New Capital Show.
Leo, great to be here.
Let's talk about the book, On My Own Two Feet. The cover of it says, A Modern Girl's Guide to Personal Finance. And yet, I read through this book and said, I don't see anything in here that wouldn't be good for a modern guy or an old-fashioned guy. What's the direction or the directive to modern girls?
So this is kind of a funny story. Naively, when my co-author, who's also my best girlfriend, Sharon Kadar, and I wrote this book, we thought we would put together a collection of pages that would actually help empower and inform strong, bold women. And our publisher, who's wonderful, and so I mean this from the bottom of my heart with kindness, was focused much more on marketing and felt that we needed a tight niche and forced us to use the G word, girl, which as feminists really made us rankle. But we like to joke and now say the book is like the Victoria's Secret catalog. Guys are reading it too. The basics of personal finance are the same for both genders. And the key point and the reason we directed the book at women is there are some unique challenges that women face distinct from men.
And let's talk about those, because that's an important angle of the book is discussing some of the things that make women perhaps different or make the experience of that women have with money in modern day America different. And one of the first things is that you told me before the show started something I didn't know. What is it? 80% of women die single.
Yeah, can you believe this, Leo? So the stat is 80% of men die married, 80% of women die single. And it's not because we're killing you guys off. It's that statistically we live longer, and with divorce rates where they are and the higher propensity for men to remarry in a divorce situation after age 50, I mean, just take a look at the obits. You'll see it. Yeah. When I first saw the stat, I thought it's got to be a typo, but it's not. And so here's the bottom line is that two-thirds of women over the age of 65, two out of every three women you see over 65 in America today, are relying on meager Social Security payments as their primary source of income. And in plain English, that means they're choosing literally between food and essential medicine.
So the implication is that, if anything, women need to plan even better than men.
Precisely, yet that is almost the opposite of what society subtly, for all of the strides we've made as women, we are still not encouraged to take complete ownership over our finances, yet 90% of us will be the sole caretakers of our finances at some point in our lives.
So in many marriages or other situations, men, and I'm a personal financial advisor, in all cases, but in many cases, men take the lead in that process. I'm assuming you believe that women need to take a full partnership role in the planning process for family finances, their own finances, whatever the case may be.
Precisely, and it's all about knowledge. Sharon and I, my co-author, we're not saying that you have to understand how to read a balance sheet in order to be a meaningful contributor to your household's finances. What we're saying is you want to know what you own, what you owe, where your important papers are, that you're thinking about the key questions. Is my household saving enough? Is my household investing appropriately? Is my household sufficiently protected for the inevitable unforeseen events that life brings? And that needs to be a dialogue that both partners in a relationship are equally as informed about.
You have a little highlight box in the book, Prince Charming is not a financial plan.
You know, I will tell you, of all the taglines that we've come up with, a man is not a financial plan is by far and away the most popular. It gets giggles from women of all age groups.
And we should also, of course, note, I think you already have, that you have a co-author for this book, Sharon, is it Kadar?
It's Sharon Kadar, and she actually has a Houston tie. She's did her undergrad here in Rice.
Really? Wow. And you live in Houston.
And I live in Houston.
And I live in Houston.
Go figure. See, 6 degrees of separation. You just can't get away from it.
Let's turn to the book. And I read the book over the weekend, and that may startle people who know me and know that I'm just struggling to stay up past 8 o'clock these days with a 2-year-old and 4-year-old. But I was able to do it because, as you point out from the very get-go of the book is short, it's inviting, it's easy to read, and if you're looking for that kind of book, your search is over. This is the book. And I found that to be the case. Short, sweet, easy to read, and as you say, it doesn't have lots of mind-numbing detail, empowers you to take charge of your life. Let's get to some of the, maybe some of the chapters. Part A, the book's divided into Part A, B, and C. The first part of the book, Part A, is talking about tools for financial empowerment. Start saving, use your credit cards wisely, understand your credit scores, protect yourself with insurance, and you talk about what types of insurance are appropriate for most people and which types are not needed for most people, and how to embrace budgeting. And we don't want to totally, what do you say, take the kimono off so that people don't have an incentive to go out and get the book. So we're going to focus on one of these. Start saving now, which is now a big issue. American savings rates plummeted in the past decade to nothing, maybe below nothing. Huge amounts of consumer debt taken on, and you start the book off, chapter one, bang, start saving now. What does that mean, start saving now? How do people do it? How should they do it?
So the first thing to know is that the money you save early on is the most powerful money you will ever save, because it has the most time to grow and compound. And just to give an eye-popping example, let's take two gals, two hypothetical women, Amy and Zandra. Both of these ladies save $5,000 a year for 10 years. Both of these women invest in investments that go up 10% a year. Now, mind you, these are very lucky ladies if they're saving $5,000 a year and their investments are going up 10%, but I'm doing this to keep the math simple. So two ladies, Amy and Zandra, $5,000 a year for 10 years, 10% returns on their investment. Fast forward to retirement, you'd think, they got pretty similar lives. But they don't. They have dramatically different lives. Amy is sitting on the beach, sipping the martini. Zandra is on the beach, serving her the martini. Why? Amy has a nest egg of over $2 million. Zandra doesn't have chump change, but she's sitting on less than $300,000. You may say, oh my gosh, how can this be? Well, Amy saved her $5,000 a year from age 20 to 30. Zandra, like so many people, waited until her 40s to start saving. And that extra 20-year head start made all the difference. And that's the biggest message that we're trying to get across to young women, is that it may seem like peanuts to you now, and it doesn't have to be $5,000 a year. If it is $500 a year, it will make a world of difference to start saving now.
So you would advise whatever a young woman can do now to put money aside that doesn't totally negatively impact her life and put her behind the eight ball in terms of her current living expenses that are necessary basic living expenses, she needs to put aside that money into a savings account.
Correct. And you highlighted something that's very important. The goal here is not deprivation. The goal here is to make sure that your hard-earned money is going towards the things in life that you need or that are truly bringing you joy. When Sharon and I talk to women across the country about saving, what we often find is that when they're really mindful about where their money is going, they'll find typically, if they're making a living wage, pockets of money that they can cut back on that don't take joy out of their lives. So, for instance, going out for drinks with people you don't even like. Well, there you go. You can save money and you can avoid emotional angst.
And we should again emphasize that this is advice that young men can take to heart as well. There is no reason that young men should believe that this advice is not for them. It is for them as well.
It is gender. The basics of personal finance are absolutely gender neutral. The one concern I have as a feminist is that the dialogue that young women tend to have with each other revolves around all kinds of other subjects, many of them testosterone-based, but not money, whereas young guys often are socialized to talk much more about money. It doesn't mean that they're any smarter about money. In fact, in my experience, oftentimes they make worse decisions. But I'm trying to get women to feel more comfortable talking about the subject.
If you're just joining us, This is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. Manisha Thakur is joining me. She is the co-author of On My Own Two Feet, a frequent guest on national financial television shows, radio shows, and in print. Our number here, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. We'll be taking your calls in a few minutes to talk about personal finance and many other issues related to finance that might be on your mind. One of the things that was told to me early was pay yourself first. That was something that always stuck with me. Pay yourself first. That's a good idea to get in your head for how to save. Make sure that each year, as you have income and expenses that come in and go out, you should always make sure that you pay yourself first and then meet other things like the drinks that you were talking about, some of the more disposable things that you could, you know, do away with should come second. But you want to pay yourself first through the savings process. Is that right?
Leo, you're absolutely dead on. So the way I like to think about it is we all have an income pie. And the pie has four simple slices. The first slice is taxes. Unfortunately, we can't do anything about it. For the average American, taxes chomp up about a quarter of your income. The next slice is the one you're talking about, savings. And here's the tough love. In an ideal world, we all should be setting aside 15% of our gross income. Gross is just a fancy word for pre-tax. So if taxes are eating up 25% of your income and you're saving 15%, that means 40% of your money is earmarked already, and that leaves you with 60% for everything else. And that's where I'm seeing the biggest problem with savings, is that people save after they spend everything else. And in our current society, what we need has expanded to such a large category that a lot of the wants have migrated over there and just kind of eliminated that space that would have been made for savings in years past.
So Chapter 5 is about budgeting, and presumably the budgeting process that people should engage in we'll make sure that that 15% gets carved out, and so that at the end of the year you've got that money remaining, or it goes in first and then you meet your other needs.
Precisely. And the simplest way to do it is if you work for an employer that has an employer-sponsored retirement plan. These tend to have scintillating names like 401k and 403b and 457 plan. Is opt to take 10% of your income out right off the bat for your retirement. Then when your paycheck comes, thanks to modern technology, not only can we listen to the show on iPhones, but you can also instruct your bank that when you have your paycheck direct deposited to immediately siphon off 5% of that and put it into a savings account. Right there before you've seen any of the money, you've got your 15% savings set aside. Now, that does mean you're going to have to live on a smaller nugget, but it helps take some of the self-discipline out of the equation.
Okay, let me ask this. We were told in the wake of 9/11 to go shopping to help the economy. We're being told now that the economy is in big trouble because people aren't spending and the government's trying to goose the economy by engendering additional expenditures and consumption by people and government bailouts and so forth. People are getting conflicting information then, it seems to me, from
Correct.
What's coming through the national news and what you might be saying in
Right.
terms of personal finance. How do people sort that information out and make sense of it? What should they do?
Two words, spend mindfully. So I think the answer is not don't spend. It's just make sure that the money you do spend is going in the area of your values. So, for instance, I would argue that most Americans haven't given, and I'm a classic example, I don't feel I've given enough, charitably speaking. And so if you got an urge to spend, I would say go make a donation to an organization that's doing work that you really believe in. That's money that'll get thrown back in the environment.
My KPFT.
There we go. Classic example. But I'm dead serious about this. I mean, that's a great way to contribute to greasing the economic wheels of our society and not wasting money.
But when people are told you got to spend for the good of the country, and you're telling them you've got to save for your own good, which should they put first if they can't do both?
I'd say for every dollar, split it in half. I mean, this is part of the thing. The whole idea behind savings is not that you take money and you stick it in the corner and you never use it again. Saving could actually be renamed future spending. That's all savings is. It's setting money aside because life has ups and downs and you can't plan for them all in advance. And so if you're feeling this conundrum, there's nothing wrong with splitting every discretionary dollar you have into two buckets. Put part away, spend part now.
So part B of the book, once you've got savings, the question is, what do you do with the savings? And part B of the book is devoted to that question, which is the path from saving to investing. And I have people who are coming, flowing through my office these days in a bit of a shell shock. I've saved all this money. I did what I was supposed to do. We've invested it in stocks and bonds and other investment instruments. And look what's happened.
Right.
They've gone down in value.
Right.
And so what do people do now when they look at and consider the process of investing their savings?
So this is a multifaceted answer. The two most important things I can say are, first, let's just talk a little bit about why you invest to begin with. Because I think people forgot this. You know, for so long it's, well, I invest because I'm going to make tons of money. No, you invest because you have the opportunity, but not the guarantee that if you invest wisely, you will see your assets grow. But the bigger picture is this. We have these little termites flowing through our economy, and their technical name is inflation. And that's just the process by which prices go up each year. And the problem is, if you don't invest, the purchasing power of your money will continue to deteriorate over time. And the way I like to think about that in plain English is, what would happen if you came home from work one day and you just flopped down on your bed and you're like, you know what, take this job and shove it. I'm sitting here for 30 years. I am not getting off my bed. Well, in 30 years' time, when you went to stand up, you'd fall on your face because your muscles would have atrophied. And that's the exact same thing that happens to your money if you don't invest with it. So the key thing to understand is the reason you are investing is to offset the corrosive power of inflation, to keep your money muscles cut and buff. And if you do a really good job, then you get the added benefit of seeing that money grow meaningfully faster than inflation. But people forgot that the first rule of investing was simply to keep up with the power of inflation.
And there are ways now, as I've talked about on the show, where if you don't prefer to invest in the stock market, you can own a treasury bond which is protected from inflation. So can you talk about that? There are some instruments There are instruments that are available that could meet your needs if you don't prefer to invest in the stock market or stocks in general. That can help out. So how should a young woman think about those types of options?
So the way a young woman or a young man should think about this, Leo, is to ask themselves first, if you've got money to invest, the first question you should ask is not, what should I invest it in? Interestingly, the first question you should ask is, when do I need to spend this money? So if you have money that you need to spend in the next 1 to 5 years, tough love. Do not invest that money. Your goal with that money is to protect it, earn just enough interest to offset inflation. That's the first mistake so many people made in this market, is they put money they knew they had to spend in the near term into stocks. Stocks cratered. Now they're losing their jobs. They're in trouble. So you only want to invest with money that you know you don't have to spend for at least 5+ years. Rough rule of thumb is 100 minus your age is the maximum amount that you should be putting in stocks. So if you're 30, and this is, you know, if you're aggressive, you can go beyond this. But for an average person, if you're 30, putting 70% in stocks would be reasonable. And the other 30% could be put in bonds. And right now, a great kind of fixed income investment is exactly what you talked about. TIPS, the inflation-protected treasury, the inflation-protected securities, which will...
was going to say, which have actually become quite attractively priced as the world has become concerned about...
deflation.
The specter of deflation.
Right.
That these bonds have become... And again, this is... As I always say, I'm not giving you investment advice. This is not actionable. The radio station is not giving you orders to go out and buy TIPS or any other investment product. We're giving you information here. But the value of TIPS has fallen recently, and if you believe that inflation is something which will reappear at some point, then they seem attractively priced.
I concur. And I, the... key is we're doing so much deficit spending right now, it's almost inevitable that inflation is going to be a word that we are all reacquainting ourselves with. We basically, Leah, we went through about a 15-year period where people just didn't think about inflation, and that's why people had kind of, I would consider, an inappropriate mindset when it came to investing. They forgot the twin purposes of investing, not just to grow your money, but also to beat inflation, and now that's going to come back into play.
Manisha Thakur is my guest today. She's the co-author of On My Own Two Feet with her partner Sharon Kedar. And we are talking about saving, achieving financial security, owning your finances, owning your life. Let's go to the phones right now. Alan's been holding for a bit on line one. Alan, welcome to the show.
Hi. Leo, great show.
Thank you. I love it.
And your guest is great. You know, one thing that I come in contact with a lot in my business is, you know, and this is especially an issue for women, which is long-term care. You know, they save, they're, you know, paying tuition, you know, for the kids, and long-term care always gets put on the back burner. And then they're in their 50s and 60s, and they've got some health issues, so it's much harder to get long-term care insurance. And women linger longer, and, you know, you can have $300,000 or something like that in savings, and, you know, mom has a stroke or gets in a car accident or something where she needs assistance, and either the family's given the care or they go into her savings and use it. And I see it every day, and I'm just wondering, do you feel that long-term care is specifically a woman's issue?
Alan, what is your business?
I specialize in long-term care insurance.
Uh-huh.
So it's something, you know, I mean, I love plugging my business, but aside from that, I mean, I got into the business because of my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I've seen it happen personally.
Yep.
So it's a serious issue that it's an ugly subject that people don't want to address, first of all. And then it's something that it's people, for some reason, say, you know what, this is something we can address later. This is something we can address later. And by the time it becomes a reality, there's almost always affordability issues. And, like, when people buy this stuff younger, it's so much cheaper in the long run, but yet it is not a priority. And I understand that. I got two young kids and you know, paying tuition and juggling daycare and all that. So, you know, how do women address this? Because women live longer and they linger longer. If an individual loses their independence, and usually this happens in the late 70s and the 80s, so it's not really, there's not an immediate need for it. But
yep.
For women,
yep.
You know,
okay, Alan. Well, let's see what Manisha has to say. It's great to have you on.
Can I plug my website?
Let me see. Laura, is that possible to do? Yep. Laura says, go ahead.
It's just longtermcareamerica.com, real simple.
Okay, Alan, thanks for the call.
I'd like to hear her views.
Okay,
on
she's
that.
Good. She's going to give it to you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. You talk about long-term care insurance in the book. You give some basically very quick advice to people. And go ahead, Manisha. What's the thinking on that?
So, in general, I think women need to think about it more strongly than men. And if you've got some extra money left over, I do think, particularly, I'm seeing more employers, at least up until the last 9 months, offer it on their array of choices, and that can be a great place to get long-term care group coverage rates. I'm torn still if you can't get it through your employer and you have to go out on your own. Those policies are much more expensive. And what concerns me is what we're seeing right now with AIG and some of the other large financial institutions. The product hasn't been around long enough for us really to know the viability. And so I still think the best thing that you can do is continue to build up your retirement nest egg. Yes, if your employer offers it, go ahead if you feel you can afford it. But if you have to go out and buy it on your own, I'd rather you spend those extra dollars and put them in a Roth IRA or some other vehicle that could provide you some protection and that you have a little more control over. And that is slightly different advice than what I would have given 3 years ago.
Yeah. And we should add that, you know, a long-term care policy covers things like how long you would be covered to stay in a hospital, what type of coverage you would have in a nursing home. And like all insurance, it's not just an open-ended deal. There are limits that are on them, and as Manisha is saying, the premiums are variable in terms of what you get. The products haven't been around. I believe in them in the way that I believe all insurance. Believe in all insurance. It's right for some people, and it's right in certain situations. It may not be right for all situations, and you need to look at it very, very carefully. Let's take Benjamin on line two. No young girls calling yet, but maybe we'll get some. 713-526-5738 is the number. Benjamin, welcome to the show.
No, I'm not a young girl. hi, Leo, right?
Yes.
I wanted to ask you some stuff. I hadn't heard your show for a while, and I've been researching other stuff on the internet about the Federal Reserve and how they're just printing money, and it kind of reminds me of the whole German thing in Germany in 1933, how they just kept printing money. And I'm wondering what you think of the chances of the dollar collapsing, the actual dollar itself, people just, you know, rejecting it all over the world.
I don't think the dollar is going to be rejected all over the world. I think that there's a lot of thinking now, Benjamin, that the dollar is
weak.
Well, that the dollar is temporarily strong right now as people have flown to safety and the safety of the dollar in dollar-based institutions. And dollar-based instruments like the Treasury bond. It is true that the Federal Reserve is printing money. The Federal Reserve
basically
is
out of thin air, you know, is what I've come to conclude.
Well, they're the only institution that has that privilege to print money out of thin air.
Seems almost like a counterfeit scheme, you know, because if we, the people, don't control that, and they can just, you know, like with the war and stuff, they're supposed to raise taxes to go to war, but they just print it. So it's inflation, so isn't that a tax, basically, on us?
It is a form of a tax. I think that's right. Good question.
I really liked Obama when I first, you know, when he was in, you know, campaigning and stuff. But like lately and stuff, I'm really questioning the guy. I mean, he put in that Robert Gates guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's going back on NAFTA, and he just kind of seems like a puppet was installed on us, and we just kind of think like, oh, Obama, you know. And on March 15th. There's a movie coming out about him called The Obama Deception, and it's supposed to, like, label everything that, you know, he's done in just the first 30 days, because that Rahm Emanuel guy, I mean, he seems like he's a terrorist.
Benjamin, thanks for the call.
Okay.
I don't know that I agree with everything Benjamin said. In fact, I don't agree with everything he said, but his call points out and points up the fact that inflation is a concern, as you put front and center in the investment chapter of your book, Manisha, that however it comes about, whether it's through people demanding higher wages or through the printing of money by the federal government, inflation is the number one enemy in an investment portfolio.
It is. We have a good 15 or 20 years of dead mental space around this issue. So let me just put the numbers out here. Say you have $1,000 and inflation is 3%, which is what is average for the last 15 years or so. Well, guess what? When you wake up in 30 years, you'll still have that $1,000 if you put it under your mattress. But when you go into the store, it's only going to buy about $400 worth of goods. And that's at 3% inflation. I'd say the odds of us having 3% inflation going forward are pretty much slim to none. So let's start moving down the spectrum. Let's say inflation is not 3, but it's 5%. Well, then that $1,000 30 years from now buys $200 worth of goods. And could inflation go periodically higher than 5%? You betcha. So that is going to be, I think, the key concern of not just consumers, but I personally believe also of the Obama administration. They're fully aware of what is going on, and they've talked about some cogent plans to try and get this debt paid off as soon as possible. And none of the solutions are going to be fun for any of us as individuals. They're going to demand trade-offs and sacrifices.
This is going to take a very delicate ballet dance by the federal government and the Federal Reserve to monitor the inflation situation and presumably withdraw liquidity from our system, from our financial system, in a timely fashion. But that is more easily said than done.
The root problem here is our financial system is profoundly complex these days, and it is incredibly global. We literally are in a world now where one domino falls and the ripple effect is geometric relative to what it would have been 15 years ago. And I think that's where the frustration is coming about. It's not a problem that can be solved in 100 days, maybe not even in 300 days. I mean, it may be in year two of the administration before we see tangible positive effects.
Next, let's take Caroline. Caroline, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thank you. I just have a quick question. I am a woman over 50, never learned my finances, personal finances. Parents never taught me these things. Husband was supposed to take care of it, but I'm one of the 80%.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm like, you know, where do you start for retirement? I have no idea.
Well, Caroline, first let me just say it. My heart goes out to you, and you are not alone. I think that's one of the most important things that you can know. I hear from women like you all over the place, and you are doing the right thing, which is to ask some questions. So my first piece of advice is to self-educate. There are a number of wonderful books out there. I think my book is a great place to start, but go to your public library, poke around in the personal finance section. I also strongly recommend checking out, if you're just getting going, there's a magazine, Money Magazine, that's in very plain, simple English, has good conservative advice. But I think the number one thing that you want to do right now is make sure you understand how much money you have coming in, how much money you have going out, so that you can get a sense of what you can start setting aside for your retirement. You know, women today, if you're in your 50s, there's no reason why you can't live to 100. So there are plenty of years you have ahead of you to save, invest, and build back up a good, solid financial base. But it starts with knowledge.
What you're saying, Manisha, I think you're telling Caroline, is what I hear, is that even if you're 50, Caroline should start taking these steps that she should have taken when she was 20. It's never too late.
It is not too late. Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, Caroline?
Sounds good.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks. Next up, we'll take Patty on line two. Patty, welcome to the New Capital Show. You're on with Manisha Thakur.
Manisha, hi, Patty. I'm really asking on behalf of my future daughter-in-law. She doesn't know I'm asking, but I need to give some advice to my son. Let me set this up real quickly. He will be finishing his sophomore year of college. They've decided to get married before he finishes school. She's a few years older. She's out. She's just getting a entry-level job. He has not had to take any college loans, but because they're getting married, he's going to not be able to keep his resident advisor position at his dorm, so now he'll have to come up with some money. My question is this. I'm going to sit down with them really soon and help them strategize of how to get through these next 3 years, because he's doing a five-year master's program. Should I advise them to go ahead and take college loans, or do everything to avoid college loans, or should I say, I'll try not to take any loans the first 2 years, save it for the last year, you know, your master's work. How do you see the whole college loan thing? I don't want them to come out in major debt, but I think if she is able to increase her income, maybe by this, you know, the third year into the, you know, his fifth year of college, his third year of their marriage, maybe they won't be as eligible for grants because she's making more income. I just don't know how to project for this three-year thing. And the other part, I know this is lengthy, but the other part of that is it better for them to be saving their money, taking the college loans, or using every penny they've got to avoid the college loans and not save anything until he's through school? That's probably what it comes down to.
Yeah, so it the unfortunate truth, Patty, is there's no black and white right or wrong answer to this, but you've got the most important ingredient, which is a supportive role model and parent in you for your son and your future daughter-in-law. I personally believe debt is a four-letter word. I personally think that what got us in trouble in this country is people wanting to have things that they couldn't afford to pay for at that time. And so I always encourage people to work harder, take on second jobs, cut down your spending to the bare bones, do whatever you can do so that you don't have to take on debt. My advice would be to encourage your daughter-in-law to have a frank discussion about the challenges and the trade-offs that are going to have to be inherent in the next 3 years, with the hopes that by not incurring any debt and working harder, you'll lay a good financial foundation for the two of them when they get going. And again, I can't say enough about just exposing young women to the basics of personal finance. I mean, reading something as simple as On My Own Two Feet, it doesn't have to be my book, it could be anybody's book, but I think really getting her to take ownership of the family's financial situation can be a way to help make her part of the solution.
I was even, as I was listening to you, I'm so glad I tuned in today, and I thought I should, when I sit down with her, I'm going to go buy the book and give it to her and say, this is a good place to start.
Patty, thanks for the call.
Okay, appreciate
it. Great to have you on. Another thing, Manisha, that comes to my mind is that it's important for people to prioritize their investments. It may be that this particular degree that you would take a student loan for is crucial and critical to a person's life, to their future earning power, that they're absolutely committed to this path of entering the profession. They need the degree to do it, and they can see fully through that this is going to be an investment that pays off. And they make that investment and forget another investment. Maybe it's doing without a car that they would take debt on for otherwise or something like that. So a lot of this is an issue of prioritizing as well and putting your highest, best investment possibility at the top of the list.
Absolutely. The key is you cannot have it all. So here's the rough rule of thumb is if you have to spend more than 10% of your gross income each year paying back debts, you have too many balls in the fire. So you absolutely, if you want to take out loans for college, then maybe you're not going to have a car, or maybe you won't be buying a home until you're in your mid-30s, not in your early 30s or in your 20s. But you can't have it all, and that's the issue. I mean, for years we felt that we could. And the reason why I'm not so excited about encouraging people to take on loans is what I'm often finding now is people are ending up in the private loan market, and you can't run away from student loans. Those things stay with you for the rest of your life, and I've seen too many cases where people take on literally $100,000 of debt, and they take jobs that pay $30,000, $35,000 a year, and that is a 3 to 4 decade life sentence of paying off student loans.
And, of course, this was the subject of Democracy Now! Earlier today, and you can, of course, go back and listen to that show and stack this show up next to that show and get a good doubleheader of financial management for students. We've got about 7 minutes left. Let's take who's been holding the longest? Tammy has. Tammy, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi, Leo. Love your show.
Thank you.
And your guest. I just wanted to know where do you buy a treasury bond? Is it at your local bank? And I'll take the answer off there. If you could just talk a little bit about that.
Okay, we'll get into that. Thanks, Tammy.
Thanks.
Manisha, where do you get a treasury bond?
Well, they're
at the Stop and Go.
I only wish it were that simple. So you can go to treasurydirect.gov and do it directly through them, which is always my preferred vehicle. It cuts out all the middle costs. You can also buy treasuries on the secondary through your brokerage firm, and that does not have to be a full-service firm, although there are many wonderful full-service firms. You can go to a Charles Schwab or a Fidelity or Vanguard, which is my absolute favorite, the lowest-cost place out there.
Yeah, Vanguard has very low cost funds. So Tammy, if you don't want to mess with treasury.gov, which is not hard to do, but if you would like to open an account, you can do it at places as Manisha's is, like Fidelity or Schwab. Vanguard, in my experience as an advisor, has the absolute lowest fees, and they as an organization are committed to low fees. They prefer to have low fees. So you can buy a fund that holds treasury bonds in it that has fees of approximately 0.1% per year, which is a very low fee, and I think you would do fine. So either way, you can buy the treasury bond directly from the Treasury Department. The benefit of having the Vanguard account is that you can buy other things as well in the Vanguard account. So if you decide you don't only want treasury bonds, you'd like to hold a different type of bond, a municipal bond, or you might want to hold a corporate stock, or something like that, you can do it all in under one account. If I said that right?
Beautifully. And Leo brings up another point, which is that, in addition, if you buy an individual bond, most of us aren't lucky enough to be swimming in so much extra cash that we can buy multiple bonds. If you invest in a mutual fund that is invested in treasuries, you will get what's called a laddering effect, in which you will be able to have participation in bonds of multiple maturities. So as interest rates move around, you've got a bit of a stronger buffer around you than you might have had if you had bought the bond on your own, although, of course, if you hold it to maturity, that negates the interest rate risk.
Yeah, you would earn a blended rate. You would all the bonds would be put into the fund's pot, stirred up, and the rate of interest you earn is a blended rate.
Like a financial smoothie.
Like a smoothie. Okay, let's take Brad on line 5. Brad, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hey, guys. I love your show, Leo.
Thank you.
Just a quick question. I see all these late-night infomercials for all these investment software packages like Invest Tools and all these different things, and I feel like you guys can just touch
run.
Yeah, just say
run.
No.
Run in the other direction as fast as possible, Brad.
Okay.
Right, Manisha?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, Brad. Those things scare me to death.
Run away as fast as possible, please.
I mean, the bottom line is this. It's like, if you want to lose weight, what's the recipe? There are a thousand different ways to do it, but it's eat less, exercise more. If you want to get your finances in better shape, it's spend less and earn more. And these kookamimi schemes that you see on TV are no different than those, you know, belts that you can buy to put around your belly so you can sit drinking a beer watching TV and, in theory, have the weight melt off.
Trading software. Come to our seminar conference. And they're pulling people into these big ballrooms, and it is a tragedy. It is an absolute tragedy.
It's looting.
It is looting. You are being looted. Run in the other direction and tell anyone else you know, whether it's on TV, radio. This is not worthy of your confidence. It's a con game.
It is. It really is.
Robin, I think you're the last call of the day. Robin, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. How about the socially responsible funds? My retirement is all that, and I wonder if they're not going to do better in the future, or what do you think about that?
Robin, thanks. It's a great question for KPFT listeners. Thanks for the call.
Robin, I feel really torn on this issue because as a human being, I want to be a socially responsible person. When I put on my cold, hard investor hat, however, what I have found is socially responsible funds sometimes, not always, have significantly higher fees. And on top of that, the set of rules that they are using to determine what investments make it in the portfolio or not in the portfolio may not really mesh up against your principles. So I personally am a believer in trying to make the right investment decisions on your own and being socially responsible with your charitable giving, because that way you can make sure your money really is speaking to the causes you believe in.
Yeah. Having said that, I agree with what Manisha says. There are, however, funds, socially responsible funds, that are coming down in cost. The fees are becoming more competitive. This area is becoming more experienced at how to assemble portfolios. And I think there are purveyors that can meet your needs and don't lose the full benefits of diversification, and where their performance is roughly in line with what you might experience from an S&P 500. My feeling is, if it makes you feel good and it causes you to have a successful investment plan and the expenses are not so out of sight and you can sleep well at night with your conscience, I say go ahead. I think it's a very slight difference.
We can find common ground. I think if fees are below a percent or below and you know how they're defining social responsibility, then you can go for it. But make sure you know what their definition is and it matches yours.
Where do people find you, Manisha, on the web?
On my own 2feet.com, with 2 spelled out, T-W-O. On my own 2feet.com.
And they can send you an email if they have questions.
Send me an email. And we also have a free e-newsletter because we get the same questions over and over again. You can sign up for it if you don't like it. Cancel at any time. But we'll send you out periodic emails with tips on the current subjects of the day.
And we are www.newcapitalshow.com. Again, you can download us on iTunes. I hope you have a great week. I will be back 1 week hence. Enjoy the weather. Nice, cool, rainy day finally in Houston. Take care.
KPFT is is now accepting nominations for listener members to its program council. The KPFT Program Council is an advisory body founded to give broader community input in programming. The PC works with KPFT's management around a myriad of programming matters. KPFT is seeking 6 listener members to participate in the program council. Visit kpft.org to apply now and make plans to attend the Wednesday, March 18th local station board meeting to be held at the Haven Center, 1827 West Alabama, between Woodhead and South Shepherd in Houston. At kpft.org, you can find full information about the program council, what it does, and how it works. You can also submit your own nomination to the program council. And don't forget to attend the March 18th local station board meeting to be held at the Haven Center, 1827 West Alabama, and speak to the board, which votes on your nomination. KPFT encourages members of our diverse listening audience to get involved in this radio station. Visit kpft.org for information about the program council. This is KPFT Houston.
Hey, KPFT listeners, there's a big party this weekend, and you're invited. KPFT's 39th birthday party at McGonagall's Mucky Duck is this Sunday, March 15th, starting at noon, ending at 7 p.m. Come celebrate with performances by Poe Girl from Canada, Randy Weeks, Patrice Pike, Jesse Dayton and Mike Stinson, Shake Russell, John Evans, Hamilton Loomis, Johnny Boy, Milt Hopkins, Sugar Bayou, and Bathory from Sweden. Also, some special surprise guests. Who will be there? Well, you'll have to come to find out.
It's a party, and you're invited. So come on out and help KPFT celebrate our 39th birthday with some of your favorite musicians on Sunday, March the 15th, starting at noon, over at McGonagall's Mucky Duck, 2425 Norfolk, just off Kirby between 59 and Richmond.
Your $20 admission ticket gets you into the big top 10 for all the celebratory festivities. Please join us.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.